Fair stood the wind for France, when we our sails advance, nor now to prove our chance longer will tarry, but putting to the main, at Caux the mouth of Seine, with all his martial train, landed King Harry. Welcome. My name is Eric Clausen, and this is the podcast of the Battle of Agincourt. The excerpt that was spoken before, or mentioned before, was from the 16th century poem by Michael Drayton called The Battle of Agincourt. The full poem is public domain and can be found at various sources online. Welcome to the first official episode of the Battle of Agincourt podcast. The prior one was just an introduction. This is my first attempt at a historical narrative podcast, and I hope to paint a full and compelling image of the iconic Battle of Agincourt. Just a note before we get going, I will be providing sources for my quotes and citations for anyone interested in further reading. Furthermore, because I feel that providing a visual aid is helpful in giving context, I will be uploading maps with place names from the 1300s and 1400s. The last thing I'll mention is that there's a fantastic historical fiction novel about the Battle of Agincourt written by Bernard Cornwell, simply titled Agincourt. The novel follows the adventures of the fictional character Nicholas Hook, an archer in the English army. Though Nicholas and his immediate story never happened, his tale is presented with the historical backdrop of Henry V's campaign, as well as the battle itself, in great detail and historical accuracy. It's a thrilling story, and I recommend it to anyone interested in medieval-themed novels. With all of that out of the way, we can begin. This episode will mainly focus on the events that lead up to Henry V's campaign, specifically the situation in France. As some of you might know, France and England, prior to the Battle of Agincourt and Henry V's campaign, had been in almost constant conflict for generations in what we know today as the Hundred Years' War. The best place to start would be to consider France. The modern French state that we know is a relatively recent creation, both in terms of geography as well as government. France takes its name from the Germanic tribe, or in reality, a collection of tribes that settled there and drove out the remaining Romano-Gallic peoples. And these invading tribes were called, collectively, the Franks. At this time, the Franks spoke a language far closer to German, and it was really only after converting to Christianity and having generations of Latin influence, remember, because of the Roman influence of Christianity for years, even after this, all church proceedings were delivered in Latin. Generations of having that Latin influence would the ancestor of the Romantic French language that we know today come about. By the end of the period that we know as the Dark Ages, we see the once unified Frankish Empire. Brought forth by the legendary Charlemagne, had already begun to split into these semi-autonomous duchies. The dukes of these territories were nominally loyal to the king. However, it would take years of infighting before their loyalty to the French king, seated in Paris, was actually assured. During this time of shoring up of lands and loyalties, one such duchy had its eyes northwards. That was the Duchy of Normandy. Normandy is going to play an enormously important role, not only at the beginning of the conflict of the Hundred Years' War, but will be the fulcrum, will be the crucible, will be the cause of conflict between England and France for generations to come. Indeed, the interesting thing about the Duchy of Normandy is that its inhabitants, the rulers, were descended from Norwegian Vikings, or Normans, Northmans, which is where the name Normandy comes from. It had been a large swath of land granted to them, to the Earl Rollo, on the northern coast of France by King Charles II. His goal was that by affording them land within his kingdom, they would then protect France, or Neustria, as it was called at the time, from further Viking invasions. The plan worked, and within a few generations, the Norsemen had integrated with the rest of the local populations, becoming Christian and speaking Norman French. I'm going to speak at length about the different dialects and languages spoken within the Kingdom of France, and the implications that the differences create and the impact that it has. But more on that later. In the 1050s, the unified island kingdom to the north of Francia, recently named Angoland, or as we know today, England, was in the midst of political upheaval. They themselves had troubles with the Vikings, so much so that for generations, a large portion of the northeast of the island was under the dominion of the Dane law. The island of Britain, the United Kingdom, had been the target of Viking raids from Norwegians and Danes for a very long time. The great heathen army in the 800 or the late 700s, early 800s, had conquered an enormous part of Britain and brought most of Northumbria under its own dominion, parts of East Anglia. And so that even after a lot of the territory was retaken by the West Saxons, with Alfred the Great at the helm, we still saw that Danish influence maintain a tremendous amount of power, particularly in the north of the country. The Anglo-Saxons of the small, petty kingdoms of Northumbria, Mercia, East Anglia, and Wessex were eventually united by the latter kingdom, and took back ownership of the lands lost to them. And despite this new unity, however, the leadership of Angoland radically changed hands often, with one instance where it fell under the leadership of a Norseman, Knut the Great. It was a Viking lord who, for a brief period, was king of Norway and all of England, in what was called by some the North Sea Empire. Political intrigue abounded, and though I'm tempted to go into detail about it, I'd no doubt end up with an entire podcast in and of itself on that subject before we'd even come close to our target area. So all I'll say is that it came to a point where, because of all this conflict, all this political conflict, where an exiled prince of England found himself in the court of the then Lord of Normandy. His Norman French name is Guillaume, but anglicized and more commonly known as William, and he would come to have the surname William the Conqueror. The English prince was Edward the Confessor, and he had his kingship usurped by Knut the Great, and had fled and sought sanctuary in Normandy. He stayed for nearly a quarter of his life there, with a few scattered attempts to take back his throne, but none of them successful. One such attempt saw his brother Alfred captured by Englishmen who were loyal to Knut, and his son, Harthac Knut, who was next in line for the throne. In order to remove Alfred from the possibility of succession, this loyal to the Vikings Englishman thought it best to make it so that this Alfred didn't have, the qualifications to rule. And the way in which he decided to go about that is he stabbed out his eyes with red-hot pokers. Rather than simply maiming him, the wounds ended up festering and Alfred died after the fact. The English lord responsible for this was called Godwin, and he was the Earl of Wessex. Edward would hate this man for the rest of his life, so desperately that it is possible that, it is possible with a big if involved there, because we don't have a lot of source material to work with, but it is possible that he promised the throne of England to William, who was his host, in the event that he should die childless. And and wouldn't you know it, Edward the Confessor never had a child. Whatever was actually said is unknown, for Edward was eventually reinstated as King of England, but found that his position had been very much weakened. The governance of the country falling into the hands of three powerful earls, the strongest of which was, well, this Godwin of Wessex. Godwin's relationship with the king, if strained before, became even more strained. And even though an attempt to, you know, bury the hatchet was made by marrying his daughter to King Edward, it did not stop the eventual banishment of Godwin and his family. According to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, sometime during this exile, William made a trip to England to ensure that Edward was going to make good on his promise to pass on the crown of England to William himself after Edward's death. However, sources show that this trip is unlikely because at the time, William was busy dealing with rebellions and insurrections on the continent. What did happen, though, was Godwin and his sons ended up returning to England with armed forces, and they had cornered King Edward and forced him to reinstate the earldom to Godwin, all of his lands, all of his titles, and also forced him to swear that after his death, his great power and prestige as a lord would be passed on to Godwin's very popular son at the time, Harold Godwinson. And, you know, Edward was childless, he was sick, and on his deathbed, he unknowingly signed the death warrant for an independent England by snubbing his supposed promise of the crown to William, and gave it instead to Harold. Harold's reign was short-lived, as we know. In 1066, William invaded southern England at a place called Hastings. There was a battle, and at this battle, Harold was defeated and killed. What followed was the dispossession of the English nobility. William the Conqueror began exiling or executing the great lords of England and enfeoffing their lands to Norman lords of his entourage. Thus, the classic medieval form of feudalism came to England. The Norman French language started replacing English as the language of the court. Prior to this, the Anglo-Saxons, though a monarchy, operated with this sort of semi-democratic council that was called the Wittenagemot, where all of the major earls would have the opportunity to speak and to vote. As a matter of fact, for the longest time, the kingship of England was not passed down hereditarily. It was, in fact, voted upon. So when the king passed away, the earls of the Wittenagemot would vote on who they thought would be the most fitting to carry on the leadership of the country. Generations after this, though, the kings and dukes and barons of England would need to speak to their subjects with interpreters, as they could not actually understand each other. Most famously, King Richard the Lionheart, the fabled Crusader king, made famous in this era, or in our era, I should say, by films such as, you know, Robin Hood. Despite being born nearly 100 years after William the Conqueror's invasion, couldn't speak a word of English. In fact, he only spent several months of his entire 10-year reign physically in England proper. It is worthwhile to speak a bit further regarding King Richard the Lionhearted. His moniker is the Lionhearted because of, one, his appearance. He apparently had this flowing kind of reddish gold hair. He was apparently 6'5", very, very strong, very, very martial, chivalrous individual. He was born in 1157. He lived till 1199 and was King of England for 10 years. He was also the Duke of Normandy, Aquitaine, Gascony. He was the Lord of Cyprus, the Count of Poitiers, Anjou, Maine, and Nantes. Many of these titles were afforded to him from his father, Henry II. However, a great deal of Western continental French territory was inherited through his mother, Eleanor of Aquitaine. As I mentioned before, Richard spent little time physically in England. We know he was born there, and as he had several elder brothers, it wasn't likely that he would ascend the throne. At a young age, he left England and spent most of his adult life in Aquitaine, the ancestral homeland of his mother. The dominions held under Richard, which he inherited from his parents, make up a striking range of territory. It is referred to as the Angevin Empire. I will include a map of the Angevin Empire from this period for anyone wanting a visual aid. The kings of this Angevin Empire were known as the first kings of the House of Plantagenet, which you will remember from the introduction, will eventually father the houses of York and Lancaster, and is the surname of King Henry V, whom we have yet to see in full. Already the context of the story is becoming clear. We begin to get a sense of the foreshadowing over the infamous 100 Years' War and how the Battle of Agincourt will come about. Now, you might be wondering, how could the French or the King of France himself tolerate these parts of France, Normandy, Aquitaine, Anjou, etc., to be controlled by a foreign king, a king of England, no less? Surely, if, one day some country invaded Canada, or more aptly the United States, and, annexed a bunch of provinces or states, there would be a reprisal. We'd want to push them out. The population might rise up and try to rebel. Why is this not happening in France at this time? Well, the answer to that is that the American or Canadian identity as a nation-state was not something that someone in France felt about his or her country at the time. There's a few different reasons for this. Regardless of where you go in Canada or the United States, you will be able to get by in English. And you can expect a lot of the same laws and rules with some state or provincial variances, but at the same time, the same overarching federal legislation is existing there, that the framework is there. Despite the feelings of identity that one might feel being, say, an Ontarian or a Manitoban, it is also reinforced by the idea that both are Canadian. Well, you wouldn't see that kind of association in France during this period. A person who lived in Calais would see themselves as a Norman, right? And they would speak Franco-Norman, a language almost unintelligible to someone who lived in Bordeaux, in Aquitaine, who would likely speak Limousin, which is, interestingly enough, where we get the word limousine. It is just a linguistic variation. The various duchies of France were filled with these kinds of linguistic variations, with divisions being between Oi, or Hua, languages, and Uk languages. Hua languages would eventually bring about the modern French that we know today, and is the standard in France. There are still small minorities speaking various Uk languages, such as Gascon, Occitan, and even Catalan, in northern Spain. Though these languages are all Romantic languages, meaning they are based on Roman Latin, they have inherent characteristics that set them apart. Hua languages, like Franco-Norman or Franco-Provencial, have a lot more of a nasal sound, like wa, I, on. The noises are coming out of your nose a bit more, these sounds are far more abundant. Think of the classic French accent stereotype to get an idea. Uk languages tend to be more guttural, with harsher emphasis on consonants. So, considering the fact that unless you were a merchant, versed in many of these languages and dialects of the places you did business, the fact that the average person would only find mutually intelligible language in their own duchy already shows that we're dealing with a system that is closer to a series of mini-countries rather than a unified kingdom. Another contributor here is the lack of immediate federal-level law from the king, who, remember, is truly the king of all these duchies, but not the kind of autocratic or dictatorial king that we would consider today. He did not have absolute lordship. The dukes and counts were sworn to his service. They were required to pay the king taxes, provide goods, harvests, summon their militias and knights whenever the king went to war, and so on, your basic feudal system. Outside of that, the dukes and counts could run their lands as they saw fit. So for the average peasant, the world was a lot smaller. You had a vague idea of a France, but the immediate driving forces in your life came from the duke. The king was a faraway, dubious figure that didn't affect your life all that much. So the people, or peasants, or lords didn't really have the nationalistic response to the Angevin dominions in France as we might expect. So we should contrast this with England, right, which for generations had a similar system of cultural division between their petty kingdoms, the four kingdoms of Wessex, Mercia, East Anglia, and Northumbria. The difference is that with the efforts of men like Alfred the Great and his grandson King Athelstan, England was unified under one throne. The Anglo-Saxon people had less variation between their customs and language as you see on the continent in France. Therefore, an English identity was able to emerge, which is why when William the Conqueror landed in 1066, it was seen by the people as a true invasion, right, and an attack on their independence as a whole. William the Conqueror didn't have an easy time of it in the aftermath. He would spend the rest of his life putting down rebellions and uprisings all over England. People were not willing to accept a foreign duke or baron or count in place of the earls and thanes that had ruled before. So, despite saying all that, it's going to sound like I'm contradicting myself a bit here, and I'm sorry if it's confusing, but stay with me. Despite the cultural and political differences between the French duchies, there was still some overlap, still some sense of familiarity between the two. It makes sense because, well, these places are all linked geographically. You can walk from one duchy to the other. All of them are Christian at this time. They all have churches, they all have masses, and regardless of where you are, the services are in Latin, right? They're not in Gascon, they're not in Provençal, or whatever. So when Richard the Lionheart inherited the duchy of Aquitaine from his mother, the people didn't go, whoa, the King of England is our new duke? You know, call the other dukes, call the King of France, we've got to get him out of here. No, they instead thought, oh, the Duke of Normandy, a familiar enough title and idea, the Duke of Normandy is now also the Duke of Aquitaine. So we can be okay with that. He just also happens, as a side note, to be the King of the English. For a long time, the English were not overly considered or they were not very highly thought of by the people of France. They knew of them, though they thought of them as a kind of a poor island nation, one that was converted to Christianity relatively late, a place that wasn't as advanced technologically, making the majority of their structures out of wood, even the nobility. In fact, the image of the English castle didn't really exist in England until after the Norman invasion. William the Conqueror himself oversaw the construction of stone castles, which prior would have just been wooden halls with wooden palisades. Militarily, they didn't seem as advanced. They fought in the kind of archaic shield wall method that we normally attribute to the Norsemen, whom the Anglo-Saxons were related to. It was a mostly infantry-based form of fighting. The French at this time were experimenting with archers, another kind of skirmishing troops, in conjunction with infantry. But most famously, and this would define France in ages to come, cavalry. France would boast the finest military horsemen in Western Europe throughout the medieval period. France is the birthplace of the medieval knight, that Disney-themed knight in shining armor, the courage, the piousness, and most of all, the chivalry. Chivalry, in fact, comes from the French word chevalier, as does the word cavalier. Chevalier literally means horse rider. It also means kind of more than that. On a contextual level, it's also the French word for knight. Chevaliers were landowners. They could afford the big war horses that would be necessary to carry them in armor, as well as have the temperament to withstand chaos, the chaos of battle. Modern draft horses are descended from these big war horses, or destriers, as they were called at the time. Huge and imposing with, you know, feathered fetlocks and, you know, think of like big Clydesdales. You know, over the years, they have been adapted and bred for a more agricultural purpose. And, you know, lighter, faster horses were favored for the military. However, in the age of chivalry, in medieval France, we're talking about big, heavy horses. And the English didn't have any of those. Right? They didn't really have much of a cavalry to speak of at all. And it is largely the reason that they were defeated at Hastings. So, you know, maybe close your eyes and put yourself in this position. Try to imagine if you were a militiaman, an English militiaman, which is what the majority of the English army was composed of. It was called the Ferd. It was basically when your lord wanted to go to war, he'd call up his landowners. He might have a few personal guards or followers who could afford decent weapons and armor, but the rest were a levy of peasants told to bring whatever they could. Most didn't have armor at all. Maybe a thick leather breastplate at best. Few had swords. Most fought with axes or even farm tools. Try to imagine you're some peasant. Put yourself in this position. You're some peasant. You've been called up by the earl who owns the land you rent from. He's been called up by the king of England. And you march. You're marching along with your brothers, your cousins, uncles, your dad, your friends. Along with people from many other villages and towns. You might have a shield or a spear. You likely have a pitchfork, maybe a leather cap as a helmet if you're lucky. And you know, for days, you're just eating, you know, stale bread, hard cheese, and you march to this beach, and you find that the army that you're facing does not look like yours. Rather than having a mass of men behind a wall of round shields, the kind of warfare you and your people have been using for hundreds of years, whether you were fighting Vikings, Welshmen, Scotsmen, or each other, you are looking at infantry split into divisions. You are being pelted with arrows and javelins by skirmishers. It's not so bad. Your shields are effective at resisting that. The infantry marches up, clashes with your shield wall. You hold up pretty good. Then you look up and see hundreds. Hundreds of just the biggest horses you've ever seen, with armored men on them, spears, swords, thundering up the beach, rounding your shield wall and smashing into your flanks. If you've ever been to a fair or a farm show and seen a, you know, a big draft horse up close, it's hard not to marvel at how big and powerful they are. Now imagine hundreds of those charging at you. Imagine the noise, the panic it would create. If it's hard for you to imagine because you've never experienced something like that before, well, then you know how the English footmen felt. This new method of warfare was brought to England by William the Conqueror and would begin to take hold among the English. The majority of the English knights at the time weren't English at all, but were Norman lords and noblemen and their sons. Some of them, no doubt, would recruit men at arms from the English population and teach them to ride and teach them to fight as mounted soldiers, but the majority were Norman. And if you ever want to Google the names of famous English knights, you will see an overwhelming amount of very French-sounding last names. So the territory held by Richard the Lionheart was vast. And as the map I uploaded denotes, the Plantagenets exercised a great deal of power and influence beyond their own borders, so much so that it rivaled the power of the King of France at the time, King Philip II. King Philip was a powerful leader. He was, of course, of the House of Capet, and would be a lifelong rival of the Plantagenets. He was nicknamed Philip Augustus, which was a throwback to the ancient Roman emperor for being such a fiercely successful ruler. He was the first king of France to be able to exercise actual power as we would see it today behind the title King of France. Remember, after all, that though nominally the King of France, his ancestors were little more than powerful dukes among a sea of dukes who grudgingly accepted his dominance at one moment and resisted him the other. Before Philip Augustus, the Capetians, had a hard time consolidating their power. The Angevin lords could be seen as superior, or seen as a superior power at this time, and had it not been for issues in dealing with troublesome nobles at home and in England, it's possible that they could have defeated the Capetians, which would change history utterly and probably eliminating the Hundred Years' War altogether. But history is a collection of what-if moments, so there's really no point in speculating what could and couldn't have happened if this was a viable option. The last what-if tidbit I'll mention in relation to this is a major cause of the animosity between Richard and Philip. It was, in fact, that there was initially an engagement set up between Richard and Philip's sister, which Richard later snubbed. This would poison the water between the two. It's interesting because the driving force in the Hundred Years' War, as we'll discover, is a question of ascension to the throne of France, which had Richard married into the Capetians and produced an heir, would have united the houses of Plantagenet and Capet. Both Richard and Philip went on crusade following the loss of Jerusalem. Might have been awkward for them. They went to Jerusalem, which had been captured by Norman crusaders 100 years before. Philip would return to France, whereas Richard would continue to fight the great Muslim Sultan Saladin, pronounced correctly as Salahuddin. He would win great victories, but he would never recapture Jerusalem. On his way back home, he would be imprisoned in Germany, captured by Duke Leopold of Austria, and then delivered to Henry the German Kaiser, also called the Holy Roman Emperor. In order to be released, he was required to pay an enormous ransom, and one that his mother Eleanor of Aquitaine raised in secret. And what is interesting is that rather than put the strain of on the peasants of their continental holdings in France, the money was raised in England. I have an excerpt here from Warrior of God, Richard the Lionheart and Saladin in the Third Crusades by James Rustin Jr. As follows. The treasure chests for the king's ransom was slowly filled with the gold and jewels of England. To raise the ransom, each landowner had been taxed 20 shillings, each layperson 1/4 of his annual income, and every church was to give up its chalices and any other valuable object it might possess. So, yeah. 1/4 of your annual income. Just, tax people show up and they demand that you fork that over. What's interesting is the narrative in the books and, the movies about Robin Hood is that, he stole from the rich to save the poor, and that, the big bad sheriff of Nottingham was always taking too many taxes from the people. Later we see King Richard come home. He's got this great return. He meets Robin Hood, and they hang out, and they're great buddies. What's ironic is that those taxes that the sheriff of Nottingham was so aggressively trying to extol on the population, he was just following orders, and ironically, it was to cover the ransom for King Richard's return. So, narrative's a little flawed when you think of it that way. Nevertheless, this ransom would cripple England economically and would lead to a very turbulent time in the future. So with the ransom paid, Richard returned home, only to find that his brother John had tried to usurp the throne. A lot of people in history are portrayed unfairly. We don't represent the best or most accurate way in which they actually conducted themselves, but from all sources, the idea that Prince John was an incompetent, lazy, short-sighted, mismanaging ruler seems to be pretty accurate. The cowardly lion king from Robin Hood who sucks his thumb, perhaps not to that extreme, but certainly was not a very competent ruler. He tried to usurp his older brother's throne. what happened was that King Philip, who, you know, had bad blood with Richard, had known that Richard was a strong leader, but that his, you know, his brother John was a weak man. He was lazy, and you know, he could be taken advantage of. So, taking the initiative, Philip pressed John into a conspiracy to undermine King Richard, with John seizing all of Richard's holdings, thinking that he could deny Richard his ransom, but he was unaware that his mother, Eleanor, had actually already paid it, and that the king was in fact returning home. Richard traveled in disguise with a group of loyal knights, until finally he returned to England at the royal seat of Winchester. There was an enormous acclaim at his return, much to the distress of John, who, you know, had he been a harder man, might have had his brother killed, and thus finishing the coup d'etat. But John wasn't such a man, and actually fled in fear, terrified at what his warrior brother would do. Richard didn't immediately chase him. Instead, he organized a second coronation for himself in England, solidifying his rulership and showing the nobles into no uncertain terms who was in charge. Following his second coronation, he returned to Normandy to chase King Philip, who, at the invitation of Prince John, was holding Plantagenet lands. It was while traveling in Normandy that King Richard came to the town of Lisieux, and after going to the church to pray, the archdeacon there, the priest, the caretaker of the church, confessed that it was at this church in particular where King Richard's brother, Prince John, was actually hiding out. So again, according to James Rustin Jr.'s book, this is what went down. So we have Richard speaking, saying, "I know you have seen my brother John. Do not deny it. Tell him to come to me without fear, for he is my brother and should not be afraid." And John, appearing at last, slunk fearfully into his brother's presence and threw himself at his feet. And cheerily, King Richard replied, "Think no more of it, John. You know not what you do. You are just a child who has had evil counselors." The irony is that not long after this, Richard suddenly dies. He is struck by an arrow during a siege. Apparently, he had a habit of surveying battles within archer range, not wearing his armor. His followers, time and time again, would warn him against doing it. And, you know, he'd probably do it to show how courageous he was, but he was struck in the shoulder. James Rustin Jr., in his book, names the archer as Peter Bazil. The legend says that following the siege, the wound began to fester and rot, and the dying king summoned this Peter Bazil to his bedside to congratulate him on his shot. He then rewarded him with gold. However, after the king dies, his nobles brutally kill Peter Bazil and take back the gift. Without an heir, the Angevin lands fell to John. And now we know John was a weak and incompetent leader to begin with, and certainly the public humiliation at the hands of his brother during their reunion must have affected his status among the barons and dukes that he was supposed to be ruling over. Remember, he was called a child by Richard. So now combine that with the fact that Richard had greatly impoverished England as a result of his ransom. The situation became tense. The dukes began to openly defy John, leading to the barons' rebellion. John's forces were swiftly beaten, and he was forced to sign a Magna Carta, a document that essentially limits the power of the crown and actually became the basis for common law, which we still adhere to today. Seeing this, Philip Augustus, who proved to be very aptly named, launched a swift and powerful campaign that saw almost all of the Plantagenet lands captured and brought under his influence. So in one fell swoop, he was able to take Normandy, Brittany, Maine, and Anjou. This had an enormous impact on the Anglo-Norman identity, as the ancestral seat of William the Conqueror was now no longer in Norman hands, but a dominion of France. In fact, this is the first time that Philip began flouting the title King of the French, which saw the beginning of a nationalist identity that was not present in France before, as we discussed. The crown of England and the duchies of Poitou and Gascony fell to Henry III, a son of John, and Henry III would try and fail to regain his possessions in France. This would instead fall to his son, Edward. And with Edward, we will see the beginning of the Hundred Years' War as we approach the Battle of Agincourt. That is where I'm going to leave off on things today. I hope you enjoyed this installment of the podcast of the Battle of Agincourt. Next time, we will be discussing the beginning of the Hundred Years' War as we approach the battle itself. And again, my name is Eric Clausen. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.